Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey there, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Very well.
You know, we're getting into that time of year. Valentine's Day is coming up, and you know, we had Jacques Torres, probably the best chocolatier in New York, certainly, and mm-hmm. certainly one of the best in the country, who was on the program just yesterday. And we're getting ready to come on Valentine's Day. And you know that I live not too far from Jacques Torres's shop in Manhattan, right?
Yes, you dash in occasionally and bring me
more
wonderful
than
little morsels.
I dash in more than occasionally. I only occasionally bring you morsels. But I made two discoveries, one horrible, powerful, and frightening discovery.
Yes.
And one delicious. Okay. The horrible, powerful, and frightening discovery came, you know, Jacques Torres sells his hot chocolate mix for like $7 a can, right?
Very, very delicious, though.
And it's not hot cocoa, it's hot chocolate. It's got like chocolate in there, and it's a little sweet, and it's got nibs, and it's got cocoa, and it's got cocoa butter, and it's extraordinary.
Great and you, depth of flavor.
And you boil the milk with it a little bit. It's very thick. It's almost like a Spanish hot chocolate, like I've had in Spain. Anyway, it was late. I was home. It was 2 in the morning. I'd had a couple of drinks. I was hungry. I'm a bachelor. There's no food in my apartment. And I made an awesome and powerful and disturbing discovery.
Yeah.
Jacques Torres hot chocolate mix is fine by the spoonful. Right out of the can, it's delicious. As a matter of fact, it's sick how good it is.
Somehow I see you.
It turns into room temperature hot chocolate in your mouth.
You've become the Nestle's Quick Bunny, just like that.
Mixed with milk, water, or your saliva in your mouth. Oh, it's so good. And then I had it again for breakfast. Horrible.
Oh, come on, man.
Okay, Jacques Torres, you can go to our website and find out how to link to Jacques Torres and get your sweets, some sweets in time for the holidays. Great guy. But he's got a new thing out. It was in. It's been written about quite a bit these days. His latest thing is chocolate-covered Cheerios, and they're amazing.
Which really doesn't sound all that important.
Oh, come on!
But you take a look at these little Cheerios, and they're perfect.
Like he preserved the whole.
Like exactly. It's a Cheerio, and he's managed to make it look like a little chocolate-covered, like a little mini chocolate-covered Entenmann's donut.
But with all of its oaty, crunchy wonderfulness. I'm an homage to Jacques Torres. Hey, we're doing a great Valentine's Day at the restaurants too. Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi. If you're looking for some place to bring your lover. Come on down. You can find that at the website. Which is restaurantguysradio.com. I want to discuss another article I came across. This one in New York Magazine entitled My Little Grocery Store. Excuse me. My Little Grocery Store is a new store in Manhattan called Kid Fresh. The idea for Kid Fresh came to entrepreneur Matt Cohen one day as he was filling his son's lunchbox. Here's this quote. It's a Whole Foods just for kids, and he says if it's beyond parents' capabilities and time to cook, they go to a place like Whole Foods for themselves. Their kids deserve the same level of quality. No, they don't.
Do you know what this reminds me of? You know, you just said it, and I realize it just rang a little bell in my head. It reminds me of the doggy pastry store.
Yeah.
Okay? It reminds me of the little doggy pastry shop. And not that I think my kids should be treated like my dog.
You're getting hate letters. You can feed your kids to pets. They're coming.
But, you know, feed your kids food, okay? Feed your kids. Your kids are, you know, you don't have to feed them foie gras. Well, feed your kids regular food.
But here's the deal. Cohen says Kid Fresh is all about purity, no preservatives, artificial flavors, or trans fats, and most of the ingredients are organic. Good so far. Shoppers walk in, and there's prepared meals organized by age group. What are you talking about? Whole foods. Yeah. Foods that are whole. That, you know what? In most cultures, and this is really a problem with our culture, in most cultures, kids eat what the parents eat.
Right. Well, and how many people do you know who make four different meals for their kids? I mean, that's very, very common. But let me take the other side of this just for one second.
Yeah.
Okay. Sometimes you have a kid who just won't eat food that's good for them.
Yeah.
You just they just won't do it. Let me give you an example.
Let me give you an example of what my father did to me. Okay? He beat me. Okay, then there we go. It was very simple.
Let me give you an example. And this is a true story from not very long ago. My 4-year-old daughter, Caroline, just about five now,
mm-hmm.
Decided that she wasn't going to eat her chicken and corn. Never, never, never. Her mother made her chicken and corn.
Yeah.
Okay. She wasn't going to eat it, no matter what.
Okay.
These are foods she likes. She doesn't like that many foods. Her mother's prepared a dish for the whole family of things that she eats. They're not her favorites, but things that she eats.
Okay.
So she decides she's not going to eat it. Okay. Well.
So what do you do?
So you serve it to her for dinner. So I'm not going to eat it. Okay. Well, don't eat it. Okay. Breakfast comes. Here's your chicken and your corn.
How did she react?
She said, I'm not eating it. Lunch came. Chicken and corn. Dinner. Chicken and corn.
Did she eat it?
I'm going to tell you, stubborn little kid that I have.
Yeah, I wonder where she gets it from.
Dinner, breakfast, lunch, dinner. She had it for breakfast the next day.
Well, even your kid gets hungry sooner or later. I admire your daughter. Are you in trouble when she's a teenager?
Oh, my goodness gracious. Mm. What she didn't know is we kept, you know, the chicken would get dried out and kind of really crummy. And what we didn't want is for her to finally eat this and for it to be as horrible as she envisioned it to be.
Right.
So we kept sneaking in new chicken and new corn in every meal.
Let's hope she's not listening to me. Your parenting ability is all cooked. I love that story. My dad just I sat at the table. I sat at the table till 1 o'clock in the morning. He tied me to the chair.
You know, one of the things that we said with our kids is we're not going to force them to eat, but we're also not going to make six meals for every kid, especially when you're making something. You know, if you made liver for me and my wife or seriously like foie gras or something like that, that simply the kids don't have a taste for. I'm not going to torture them and make them eat foie gras. But at the same time, I've made something you like. You can eat it or not.
I think that, yes, we need to make some accommodations for children.
And I'm going
to
get some hate mail. But, I can feel it.
But I don't – having a separate grocery store for your kid,
mm-hmm.
it's – you know, the thing about food and the thing about meals, it's where the family comes together to share a meal. And if you're okay, the kid doesn't want this, the kid doesn't want that. But if you not only take your kid to a separate restaurant or get takeout from four different places or go to, you know, have separate food for your kid, it's not about you.
You know, but I want to
sharing a meal is not about you.
But again, I want to play devil's advocate here because one of the things that I've reverted to is I do a lot of my shopping, especially for proteins and things like that, at our restaurant mm-hmm. for my family.
Right.
Okay. I bring home raw chicken. I bring home pork. All those types of things because I'm not seeing what I want at the grocery store
right.
for my kids. And there are certain sacrifices, certain compromises I'm willing to make for myself that I'm not willing to make for my kids
yeah, but that's,
as far as food quality
but
goes.
But that's different. That's you making different choices for your kids. That's not your kids dictating a separate menu for themselves.
Correct.
When you get invited over to someone else's house, you eat what's put in front of you. I remember I got invited over to a Norwegian friend's house when I was a kid. And I come from an Irish background, but I'll take Irish over Norwegian any day of the week. And I've known that since I'm 12. But still, you sat and you ate it because a meal is about coming together. And I think kids need to know that young. When we come back, we're going to be talking with one of our favorite food journalists, Kim Severson. We're going to be talking about power relationships, reservations in restaurants, and how you can maybe or maybe not get a check next to your name in the reservation book. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Kim Severson. Kim is an author and a food journalist. She's a regular contributor to the New York Times, and she's one of our favorite journalists.
Kim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, nice to be here. How are you guys doing?
Oh, we're doing great, and you've written a couple of articles recently about cool stuff that we want to talk about.
Yeah, you were on not too long ago, but, you know, when you're as prolific as you are and write about stuff that really gets us going, we get you right back on the show.
Oh, great. Well, it's a living, you know.
Us too, thank heaven. I want to talk with you about, you wrote recently about Pascal Raffaud's service, Prime Time Tables, and about in an article entitled Insider's Access to Hot Tables. You want to tell us our listening audience what this sort of has brought up?
Well, it was an interesting idea that this fellow had. He'd been doing a kind of a concierge service for a little while. He's a former concierge at some St. Regis and the Ritz in London, and he, or in Paris, rather. So he came up with this idea of getting reservations at some of the best tables in New York City at some of the prime times, the difficult times, the 8 o'clock hour when everybody seems to want to eat, and then selling those reservations on a website to people who are members of Prime Time Tables. And for as little as like $35, for example, you could get into, you know, Café Bleu or, you know, ask some of the higher-end restaurants, Rubichon and some of those. So some of the food bloggers got a hold of this, and it turned out then to make many restaurateurs in New York crazy because they felt like some guy was making money off of their reservations. It also got complicated because he's married to one of the prominent restaurant PR people in town, and people felt like maybe there was some horse trading going on. Restaurants that had a relationship with him through his concierge service felt like, now this guy's making some extra money off of my, you know, my relationship with this guy. And the worst thing is, he became sort of a champion of the people. Suddenly people are like, I can, you know, no longer will I be one of the chumps who can never get a table. For $35, I can eat somewhere cool on Saturday night at 8 o'clock.
But aren't you now the chump who's paying $35 for the reservation that somebody else got for free?
Right. Isn't that the question?
Oh, and then what happens when he's full? I wonder if there could be a second generation of someone who knows him who can get you a membership that you'd pay them. Here's the idea. You start off your article where you say, you know, people who go out to eat in New York are divided in plenty of ways, but the division that matters most is you're either someone who can get a great table on a Saturday night or you're not. And what's funny is the restaurant reservations have become kind of a source of social power, clout and power.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you think that's different now than it was 15 years ago?
Oh, I don't know that it's that different. You know, it's always been who you know and who you can get in. And, you know, the great French restaurants that started in New York, you know, after the World's Fair and in the 60s and 70s that became terrific, you know, Caravelle and Le Cirque and all those. I mean, they made their living on keeping people out and keeping only the best people in. So mm-hmm. This is not a new game by any means. You know, the term Siberia, being seated in the worst table in the restaurant, that came out of, you know, this whole game that was being played in New York and at the Russian Tea Room. And, you know, this is not a new thing. But I think that more people are eating out now, more people feel like they're part of something, you know, Food Network and shows about restaurants. So I think your average person feels like somehow they, you know, they're part of this restaurant world in a way that they didn't before. Before you thought, I got this only for the rich people, I'm never going to get in.
Mm-hmm.
Now it feels more like a democracy, you know, eating out at nice restaurants are somehow a right, you know, I should be able to get in there. It's that whole, you know, collapsing of the middle class. So now you have people getting little bits of the luxurious life through good chocolate or expensive coffee. And I think restaurant reservations are the same thing. So I think it's changed a little. But the bottom line is, you know, you slip the maitre d' some money, you're going to get a table. I don't think that game's changed.
Kim, let's talk about keeping the best people in and the worst people out. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, we've had this discussion for, and actually I think it'd be another good piece, this notion of window dressing tables and, you know, having prominent people in. Some of it is, you know, simply the investors in a restaurant are always going to get a table. There are certain prominent names that will get a table. There are, you know, although the New York Times does not allow us to ever use our names to get tables for ethical reasons, probably many journalists could call up and get a food journalist and get a table if they wanted to. You know, so I think the restaurants want to have certain kinds of people, and they certainly want to have big spenders. I interviewed Thomas Keller of Per Se and French Laundry for this article, and they talked for a long time about wanting to make sure that you got somebody, Thomas said, somebody who's going to pay $700 for a bottle of wine as opposed to $350 or, you know, $30 in many of our cases. But The idea is to get the big spender in there. There's lots of different ways they do it.
I think one of the things that's very interesting is, you know, the restaurant being sort of a last bastion of small business, there's a delicate relationship between a restaurant and its customers, especially if it's a small dining room. And I think this new idea of having a service where you can pay to get access to a table really throws a monkey wrench into that power relationship. And we're going to be talking more about that with Kim Severson, who's written an article for it recently in the New York Times in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagatta and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. And our guest today is Kim Severson of The New York Times.
Kim, you know, let's take away the people who go to, and we were just talking with Kim about people getting into restaurants and how they get into restaurants. But let's take away the people who get into restaurants because of their celebrity, let's say. Does the restaurant have a responsibility to hold seats for its regulars and for its investors, or should it kind of be first come, first served, everybody has an equal chance?
Well, you know, restaurants, I think, thrive on relationships, and that's I think James Beard said that the best restaurant is the one that loves you the most, and there's something to that. You know, if you go into a place that you frequent a lot, there's a relationship there. And Danny Meyer, who was quite upset about the idea of people selling reservations at his restaurant, talked a lot about that relationship. And he said, you know, if you want to get a table, you need to become a regular, and I guarantee you'll get a table. And I said, well, that's, you know, how do you do that? And he said, oh, you could do it in 1 week. He said, show up one night, just ask to walk in, ask to sit at the bar, have a meal, talk to the bartender, talk to the waiter, ask to meet the chef, make a big deal about the food. Make another reservation for later in that week before you leave the restaurant and leave your business card. Come back, for that reservation, you know, make a big deal again, tell the chef how great it is, and, leave a good tip. And he said, you'll be a regular for life. So you can invest 1 week of your life and become a regular at any restaurant in New York. This is his theory. Whether that's true or not, I think it's a little bit of hyperbole. But I think that idea of having a relationship with a restaurant is nice. I like it. If I go to a place in my neighborhood where they know me, I have a better time, you know, and I feel like, you know, the relationships are, it's one of the great things about dining out. On the other hand, and restaurants get to run their business the way they want to run it. I mean, it is not a democracy. You know, just because you happen to want to eat there doesn't mean you get to. And I'm sure you guys know, it's one thing if you're per se and you're forever turning away people. It's another if you're a small business owner trying to get butts in the chair.
Yeah, one of the concerns is, you know, you get a trendy review comes in and you're going to get influx with new people. And when it's over, you're by yourself.
When we come back after the news, we're going to be talking more about getting the right reservations at a great restaurant with Kim Severson of the New York Times. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey, 1450. WCTC with The Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today our guest is Kim Severson of the New York Times. She is an author and a food journalist that we respect a great deal, and you can find her work very often, insightful work, on the New York Times website. We do all the time. Kim, we were talking before the news about reservations in restaurants and sort of the power relationships of getting the reservation in the hot restaurant. I think they said that the hardest reservation to get in the world right now is Il Bulli, you know, in Barcelona. And I got a friend hooking me up. I'm using my contact, somebody who knows a great chef in Madrid, to get me a reservation this year at Il Bulli.
This year, you're making – it's like, you know, that. How did it come to be that it would have to – make one reservation at a restaurant our highlight of our year. It's amazing. But if you can get a table, let me know. I'll come with you.
Well, you know, it's funny. Not only that, I'm not going to Barcelona and saying, can you get me in when I'm there? I'm saying, listen, Jimmy, get me in at Il Bulli and just give
and
me enough
tell
time.
Tell me when I'm going.
Give me enough time to book a flight.
There it is.
But in this unusual power relationship, something interesting is I think that a restaurant does have a right, especially a small restaurant, but any restaurant has a right. You know, we talked about how you can become a regular customer by becoming someone who's known to the restaurant and supports the restaurant. That's one way. The other way is, of course, to be J-Lo. You're just a regular. Mm-hmm. Boom, you get in. Because it's in the restaurant's interest to have J-Lo sitting at the table, because everyone's, I was at Gramercy Tavern last night, and J-Lo was there. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's in your interest. And Mark talked about the fact that when you get a bunch of reviews, you'll get swamped with the trendies for 6 months. But then when the trendies leave, if all of your regular customers haven't been able to get a reservation,
right, if you've crowded your regulars out, for
they may not come back. So
what do you do in a situation like that? How do you manage that at a restaurant?
I think that
you
what
you and say, are you a trendy? You can't come in.
No, but I think you do hold some of your reservations for regular customers. I'll tell you what's an interesting.
I mean, I'll be very honest with you, Kim. That's what we do. When Saturday night at 8:00, I'm holding a few tables for my prime customers for those people.
What's funny is,
and actually what I tell a lot of those people who call and say, you know, what they'll do is they'll go to the reservationist, they'll go to the office manager, then they'll kick the third level, they'll kick it up to me for somebody who's trying to get that table. I hold those tables for those people, and what I tell them is, listen, I'll have that table for you. Unless someone just like you called me right before you did.
I have your table, Senator, unless the mayor called a minute ago.
Right, right.
Because I've only got one of them. But I think what's interesting here is that, you know, we do manage those reservations. And I think Mario Batali is one guy who did a great thing. And we have a very formal restaurant and Stage Left. It's, you know, almost all the tables are booked up. And Mark and I might hold one or two in our back pocket on a busy night until the day of. But we do with Catherine Lombardi Restaurant, we only take 70% of the room in reservations. We hold most nights 30% of the room for walk-ins because I want people to think, and I stole this from Mario Batali.
Yeah.
You can stop in and, you know, there's a good chance we'll have a table. You know, you might have to wait a little bit. But,
yeah.
And
at Babbo, you know, there's not a good chance you're going to – I mean, he does do that. And I actually talked to him about this reservation service and – he said, we do not hold any special tables for anybody, but we do have that section that's set aside for walk-ins.
Right.
And he goes, but you can get it. He goes, unless you know Joe or me, you know, his partner,
mm-hmm.
you can't get a table. You know, you can't call up just to get a special table. But then I think, how many people does Mario know?
A lot.
Like hundreds.
Hundreds?
Yeah. Exactly.
I think you missed by a couple thousand.
Hundreds who could actually get to him and offer a table. Let's say that.
But here's the issue. This guy sets up a service where he's charging $35. He's somebody who's sort of in the know. And look, people call me and say, hey, can you get me into this restaurant or that restaurant because I know you know a guy. And sometimes you do it as a favor. I'm sure you have the same thing that happens with you, Kim.
Mm-hmm.
But when Pascal Riffaud has primetime tables where you pay a fee for him to use his connections to get you a table, you know, he says in your article, he says, well, what's the difference between giving a tip to the concierge or the maitre d', to the concierge, let's say, for getting you a great table? And I put it like this. This is how I see it. I think that, you know, giving a tip to a concierge who uses his connections and his regular relationship at a restaurant to get you a table, you know, giving him a tip is sort of like sending him flowers the day after. You know,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to giving him $50 before. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think it changes the nature of the relationship, and you know, it's a fundamentally social relationship, don't you?
Yeah, it's very interesting too. The whole idea that we, you know, the it's kind of like, I don't know, somebody when I was doing the story talked about being a high-class hooker, that there's just this level in which you would sort of pretend you're at this place and you're eating a meal, and you're, and then the bill comes as sort of a unpleasant afterthought, you know, this idea that, you know, I mean, it's very few other businesses where it's like that, where you sort of, you know, you want to pretend like you are somebody, you're having this meal, you're, you know, a guest of the restaurant, and then the money thing is just sort of put aside. And there's that relationship idea, you know, that I think is so important and really does make you feel better when you're at a restaurant where you feel like you are being cared for somehow. And breaking it down to strict money, like $35, yeah, you can get this seat and, you know, tip me ahead of time, mm-hmm. you'll get the seat. There's something kind of distasteful about that.
Well, and there's also, I think there's a growing, you want to be in a place where you feel like you're hospitable, but there's also, and I think there's always been this, but there's always been the idea that you want to be in a place that nobody else can get into. You want to be in the in crowd. And I think a way that some places are, you're seeing this grow, in Frank Bruni's article, which is being widely referred to, I don't know if you know this, as the grumpy article, that Frank Bruni wrote a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
He sort of bemoans some of these trends. But one of the trends with people trying to, and I think business owners trying to set themselves apart, is places like Milk and Honey,
mm-hmm.
Who are just... they don't want to be in the mainstream press. They want to appeal to a small number of clientele. And they're not really looking for the superstars, or they just want a regular core of clientele. And so, like, Milk and Honey doesn't publish its number, which is a bar, cocktail bar, we've talked about and referred to mm-hmm. on the show before. What do you think about that trend of, like, the secret door kind of place?
Oh, you know, and, like, the La Esquina is the same way, and... you know, Manhattan, where the idea is they just wanted to be sort of clubby and just kind of a extended social network of people who all knew each other. But by doing that, you become even more exclusive, because especially for a New Yorker, if I can't get something, it makes me want it even more, right?
Oh, sure.
So, you know, I mean, although I think the idea of just trying to have a restaurant of regulars and locals is a great thing, and I think Graydon Carter, even for all the crappies. Can I say crap on the radio?
Yes,
no, you just did, actually. the 6 seconds delay button didn't go off, so the engineer thinks it's fine.
Anyway, for all the headaches that people give him about not giving a phone number out for Waverly Inn, and it is kind of an exclusive thing, but I think his idea was just to have a place that he and his friends could go and hang out and not necessarily make it open to the public. But again, it's that idea of restaurants as some sort of public utility, as this place that I have a right to go into, and if you're not going to give me the phone number... you know, that feels offensive to me on some level, and I can't quite articulate why. It's just that in this country, you're open for business. You know, we're all equal. I should be able to come in and get a table there. If you're not going to give me the number, I feel like you're putting yourself above me. You know, it just... and yet, I want you even more.
Right, exactly.
You know?
That's what I see. I mean, I see it's... I think that Graydon Carter has the right to serve or not serve whoever he wants in his restaurant. But you do kind of feel like by him saying... you know, only the privileged few get in, that what he's saying is I'm at this level above you, and unless you're at or near my level, you can't come.
Right, exactly.
I think one of the points that Frank Bruni wrote in the Time, in the article that we all in the industry now referring to, is the grumpy article, is the power...
There's so many grumpy articles you write. It's hard to...
oh, this one,
no.
This one was especially grumpy.
Admit,
come
yeah.
on.
That was the king of all grumpy articles.
Yeah, yeah.
But the nature of the change in the power relationship, and what he said was, and this is in many cases very true, you know, it used to be that they were lucky, felt lucky to have us, and now all too often it feels as though the nature of it is you're so lucky to be here. And I think, while I disagree with a lot of things he said in that article, I think that is all too often the ethos. And it's usually, to me, I don't think happens at the best restaurants, the guys mm-hmm. who are really doing a great job, men and women who are really doing a great job, whether it's cocktails, chefs, or whatever. But don't you think that power relationship is switched around a little bit in a perverse sort of a way?
It has. And it just feels, and I don't know, maybe you guys have some better sense of this, if that's a recent phenomenon or not, but there is this sense of, you know, you're doing me a great favor by allowing me to pay you $200 for dinner. And I don't like that feeling, although I often feel when I go into a restaurant and at one of these restaurants and I get treated really well and have a great experience, I feel like I've beat the system somehow. I go in expecting to feel like a chump and get, you know, bad service and pay too much money. And when I don't, it's always like, oh, you know, it's a... it's a huge cause for celebration, but it's an exhausting game to play. You know, people just want to go out and eat, and they want to, especially people who don't have a lot of money to spend going out to eat, and that one or two times a year where they might go to a really nice restaurant, it just breaks my heart. You know, they get this kind of treated poorly.
You know,
they go in feeling already, you know, less than, and they get treated bad, and it's their, you know, their big savings and their big night out,
yeah.
And it breaks my heart.
I don't mind jumping through hoops for a reservation, but I want to be treated very special. If you make me jump through those hoops, I want to be treated very specially when I get there.
That's an interesting thing that they added about it. Once you're paying extra money for a reservation, you pay $35 or $40 extra money for this reservation, then the restaurant's got this added expectation. Not only do I have to provide you with, you know, the meal that I think is worth the money I'm charging you, but now I've got to add an extra $40 worth of experience to this, or somehow I've got to treat you better. And they were quite concerned about that, too.
We're going to take a short break and come back and talk more with Kim Severson of the New York Times about reservations at your favorite and maybe restaurants that soon will be your favorite restaurants in New York and around the country. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:47.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our guest today is Kim Severson of The New York Times. We've been talking about reservations and what happens when you get them and how you get a check next to your name in the reservation book, how you get in when maybe the restaurant says it's full. You know, Kim, you touched on a point before the break that I thought was really tremendous, and it speaks to a staff note that we have had in our restaurant for a long time. Catherine Lombardi is a more casual restaurant, but Stage Left is our, you know, sort of flagship fine dining American restaurant. And it's not an inexpensive restaurant, but we say all the time to our staff, and I think sometimes restaurants miss this, and sometimes they really get it, but we say, listen, you know, there are two types of people who are coming into the dining room this evening. And some of the people who are coming in here make millions and millions of dollars and can dine anywhere they want. And we have to be great for them. Because if we're not perfect, they're not coming back.
They're going someplace else.
Mm-hmm. And
they can go anywhere they want.
And the other kind of people we're having are the people who go out to a restaurant like this once a year, once every couple of years, for their anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And they saved up for it. And this is a big deal.
And they've been thinking about it for 4 years, and they still have the review of your restaurant from 2001 on their refrigerator waiting to come to your restaurant.
And if you screw it up, you've really done a lot of damage. You know, people, life happens in restaurants. And I think there's a huge responsibility to take care of everyone democratically. Ruth Reichel, when she became the food critic for the New York Times, wrote that famous article, The Two Views of Ruth Reichel, which was where she sort of excoriated Cyril McConey for,
mm-hmm, right,
for discriminating against your average Jane at Le Cirque. What's the state of restaurants today? Do you think people are paying as much attention to the average Joe as they should?
You know, again, it so varies with each restaurant, but I can tell you, and I'm always hypersensitive to this, and I go out to eat in a lot of restaurants in New York and never go out as in any way that identifies me as a Times writer, just for, you know, obviously it's much, much more fun and provides much more research than any other way. And it's stunning to me the amount of bad service, kind of mediocre food, and expense that people put up with. And so that's why when you find a really good restaurant that provides you with something you like and you feel comfortable, it's so worth it. But, you know, just the way that people churn, you know, particularly the tourist crowds that come to eat at certain restaurants that have a name, it's terrible. It's also, you know, a restaurant gets popular, And if you go in a month or two after a great review, often the kitchen can't handle the business, and it drops off. And I know, it's always a terrible thing in the restaurant criticism business. You write about some place, and people are going to go and have the experience, and you worry that the restaurant's not going to be able to keep up. So somebody reads your review, they go a month or so after the restaurant, gets it, and they go, this critic is an idiot. Mm-hmm. This is the worst experience I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there's a real sense of arrogance, and cranky as Frank was, I think he was right on. There's just this incredible sense of arrogance in restaurants today, which is too bad. But, for every experience like that, you'll go to a place and have a great time and feel like this is really worth it. I went to Boca Rio last night in Manhattan, and it's a place that's it's a new Spanish tapas place, and I just it's one of the places that's so popular nobody ever goes there anymore.
Yeah.
But boy, we had just a great, and I don't mean to give them a plug, but it was just truly one of those great experiences. I think it was because it was so cold that it wasn't too crowded, but it just kind of renews your faith for restaurants. I actually have a question for you guys. What's the secret to getting a table at one of your restaurants? How do you become a regular?
How you become a regular? Well, I'll tell you, we're pretty democratic about the whole thing. We do have 225-seat restaurants in New Brunswick now on a Saturday night.
Right, Saturday night at 7:30 is just, is a reservation we don't even have. It doesn't exist.
Right, but I think that if you want a time where it's very difficult to get a reservation, we always take a waiting list. I'll be honest, if the mayor of New Brunswick calls and wants to come in, I'm going to do what it takes to get him in there. I might have a table in my back pocket until the day of, or what usually gets you in is on that waiting list. We try to be democratic, and what happens is when we confirm reservations the day before, usually something will change, something will shift. There'll be a room to shimmy someone in there. But look, if my cousin calls or the mayor calls, or the chef's mother calls.
But I'll tell you something else as well.
They're going to go to the top of the waiting list.
Right.
I'm not going to bump anybody, but they're going to go to the top of the waiting list.
If your story is really good, too, that helps, okay? I've been trying to get into your restaurant for 3 years on Saturday night, it's my wife's birthday, and she said, I want to go to Stage Left. There's no other restaurant in the world I can go to.
But also, Mike Baker is a guy who grows our herbs and comes to our restaurant once in a while. You have a guy who grows my herbs? You go to the top of the waiting list. I do whatever I can to get you in. And it is about being known, because we value our regulars so much that, yes, they want to come someplace where they're known, and I want to have people who the restaurant knows come into the restaurant, because it gives me the chance to establish that relationship.
And the other thing is calling far enough in advance. If you call me a month in advance, you can get into my restaurants at mostly any time you want to.
And being a little flexible with time. I mean, we're not in the Manhattan.
Right.
Usually it's like, you can come at 3 in the afternoon or 2
right.
in the morning.
Right. Now, does slipping a 20 or a 30, I don't even know how much one would slip a maitre d' these days. But and I know I'm such I would never do it right, and it would be awkward. I'd like to put it in your palm. When do I get it? I just want to open my wallet and say, I don't know how to do this, but the money and tell me.
I think slipping the maitre d' $20 to get you a nice table on the way in is something that's really fallen out of fashion. That used to be the way it was 20 years ago.
Doesn't work, huh?
However, if you are a regular...
God, there goes that $20.
So, hold on. I'm not going to say it didn't work. I just said it fell out of fashion.
We have to take a quick break. We'll come right back and talk more with Kim Severson of the New York Times. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:56. Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking with Kim Severson of the New York Times. You asked a question about slipping the maitre d' a tip. I will tell you, we're agnostic about this at Stage Left. I have no idea what goes on, and I don't want to. No, I'm kidding. I do sometimes slip the maitre d' if I want to be a regular at a customer, all that stuff Danny Meyer said to do, and then slipping the maitre d' $20 on the way out and saying, thank you very much, it was a great time, while shaking his hand, and there's $20 in there.
Okay.
Never hurt. If you want to call back the next time, and be sure you get that maitre d's name, so you may be like, I want to talk to Pierre, maybe that can help you around, next time around. But I'll tell you, Kim, the way that you get a reservation at our restaurants is you call us up and you come down and you eat with us.
Okay. I got to come eat with you sometime now.
I would love it.
I want to ask one more question about this whole situation of the 35, paying somebody money to get you a reservation at these restaurants. Does it happen at some point that per se says, okay, you want to come Saturday at 8 o'clock? I'll hold a reservation for you, but it's $50 more. It's $100 more. It becomes like an airline.
We got 30 seconds to answer that question.
I think that that's going to take some of the fun out of the game.
I hope it never happens.
Once we concede that, we're conceding that we're losing that whole little bit of hospitality. So I'm against it. Plus, it's too expensive for me. So.
I'm with you, Kim. It's been great. Thanks for spending the hour with us.
Sure.
You're wonderful.
Thanks,
okay,
Kim.
We'll talk again.
Thanks.
We restaurant owners, I think what we'd rather do there is just have you come and enjoy yourself.
I would. Anyway, that's Kim Severson of the New York Times. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.